Welcome to part two of podcast number 55, featuring Rich Schapelsky and Adam Fox of Kennard Vineyard.
Well, and the whole idea is it's such an expensive process. And let me ask you if I could, for your, let's just say your cab, what does it sell for?
45.
Okay, so that is a very reasonable price.
No, it's very reasonable.
Especially for that
small
for 3,000. Yeah, that's actually very good.
And that's mainly Rich's fault, actually. I've been trying to raise prices for a long time, but well, it's the supply and demand. I mean, we have an unbelievable demand for the wine and not a lot of supply, but Rich has been adamant about making it a wine that is accessible to everybody.
I believe,
don't make any money on it.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people that either they can't afford to pay it or they don't want to pay it, and I could fall in that category very easily a lot of times. I mean, you know, but I wanted to produce a wine, a very good estate bottled wine, that was affordable to people, and 45 is very reasonable. Our Bordeaux blends go for 55, which is again very decent
for an apple wine. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And we do have our reserve cab and reserves in. They go at a higher price. So
now I know we're looking at the vintages I see in front of me are 8 and 7. And now this is an official AVA. Mm-hmm. So will that appear on your label in the future? Is that something important to you to have on the label? Or?
It's funny you mentioned that. The 2009 vintage, we are relabeling. This has been the label since 84. And it was basically one wine at that time, so it was just the Zinfandel. But now, since we have three proprietary blends, a reserve cab, a reserve Zin, and an estate cab, well, they're all estate, but just our normal cab and normal Zin, we now have 7 wines. It was time to designate the different styles, so we're doing new labels, new bottling. Yes, we toyed with the idea of putting Calistoga AVA on it. But I think a lot of people still don't know Calistoga, and so we left it more general and just left it Napa Valley Estate. But it is mentioned on the back that it's grown and bottled in Calistoga.
I think in the future we probably will. I mean, we have Calistoga has some great, wineries up here and some great. I mean, it's a great area to grow the grapes of Napa Valley, and a lot of people know that, but a lot of people don't. So.
I think more and more people are trying to come a little further north to be able to explore a bit more, and then realizing, of course, you can connect up with Sonoma if you want to, and that's what you do, is you learn by being able to discover new places. And here on Silverado Trail, quite a few places have opened up in the last couple of years.
Yeah, definitely.
You have the new B. Sellers place, you have Pfeiffer Pob, you have all kinds of places down here.
So we have Vengay right across the road, Karen Cake Bread up the road.
Karen Cake Bread makes an awesome Sauvignon Blanc. I think one of the best Sauvignon Blancs I have ever had.
We have there's a lot of small, really good producers up here. And Toffanelli next door.
I think a lot of people look for the small things. Okay. So, no whites whatsoever?
No whites.
No whites. Nope. I like red wine. My property, I can do it.
Good. I like that. How did you arrive at the name?
My nickname, Duck. And it was back when I graduated from college. It's a whole group of, we were living down in the Bay Area, and Sharon, a good friend of mine, we were going to go horseback riding, and there was probably about 10 or 12 of us, and I'm kind of bouncing around. She just says, "You look like a rubber duck in a tub," and it stuck. I tried to get rid of it, and it never worked, so I decided, well, we'll go with it. So we Kennard, French for duck. And that's how we came up with the name.
Yeah, I obviously figured with the label, which is, by the way, a beautiful label.
Yes.
But I want to note, just for the sake of this interview, it is the only bird not represented in the background today.
True.
We have just about all the others.
Well, you're right. You haven't heard the rooster over there, Elvis, and he is usually very loud.
Yeah. I'm sure he's just waiting for his
cue.
He's
waiting for his cue.
Yeah, once we get into a little bit more. But are you planning on keeping the duck on the label?
We are going to have a duck, but not this. Actually, we had a contest back in 84 and came up with this label, and Adam came along and told me I had to change. So... I'm kidding. I went along with it. It's
just actually, updated a little bit.
We're just updating it a little more, right? We still have some ducks on the label, so, but not. This is like a duck laying on water.
I thought I killed it.
That's okay. Was that a duck I heard?
A lot of people think it is.
Help yourself. Whatever.
What would you prefer? We're gonna start.
Why don't you start wherever you would start me off?
Okay. This is the 2008 Zinfandel.
So, Adam, is this a dream for you? I mean, especially being a chef and then going into distributing and then to be able to just be here to touch it, to be part of this process. I mean, is that something you've always wanted to do?
Actually, yeah. If one was would go back and look at my high school yearbook, I think there's mention of working or being a winemaker at some point. That was, you know, 20-some-odd years ago. So yeah, it's a dream come true. It's a dream job, and it's particularly nice to work at such a beautiful place and with someone who is so adamant about quality and creating unique wines. We had several hundred producers in the portfolio, and this was the one that stood out as had the greatest potential to be a major, major player, I think, down the road.
Is it a little bit of pinch me?
Yes, there is. I constantly have people do that to me.
No, I won't. I promise you. You're far enough away.
And he is a very good chef. We've had some of our events here. Adam has cooked for some dinner parties. We actually just did one in the city for our wine club members. And
just for a moment to go back into when you were a chef, how long were you chefing, if you will?
I went to school back east for film and television. It's a long, convoluted story, but I grew up in Los Angeles, so I naturally kind of gravitated towards the film and television business. I went to school for that. But when you're graduate and you're trying to get into the biz, production work is very sporadic. It's, you know, you work on a movie for 3 months and then you're out of work. Well, most people go and they work in a kitchen, they're a waiter or so. But I didn't really have the skills to do that, but I was always really interested in cooking. So even in high school, I had summer jobs as a cook. So I bounced around between jobs at a bunch of restaurants in Los Angeles and ended up working at some of the top ones. Worked at Campanile with Mark Peel and Nancy Silverton, who went on to do La Brea Bakery. And Mark Peel's a top chef on the TV shows, and learned a lot of skills that I have since taken with me and honed over the years, doing restaurant consulting work and lots of private events. So, to cook here and to entertain and to incorporate the wines and all the menus has been just spectacular.
And I'm sure for you, pairing has got to be the best part. I mean, here you get these two great things you can bring together and really bring out all the characteristics.
Yes. And also having the, you know, the whole Bay Area for inspiration and just the produce. I mean, on this property, I think we probably grow everything that you can grow in California. There are how many different kinds
of like
fruit trees?
25 fruit trees. Wow. Different, you know, we have cherries, plums, peaches, pears, figs, persimmons. But we also have our garden beds, and we have way too much. We have orange trees. I mean, we have some blood oranges over here and lemon trees.
There's peppers and tomatoes. There's 17 kinds of tomatoes. There's eggplant.
Heirloom tomatoes.
I mean, I was here for a month and only went to the store to buy cheese and meat. I swear to God, I never hit the produce section. And that's, you know, that's amazing to do, to live off the property. To incorporate the gardens and the food into the menus, it's really a dream for any chef.
Well, in Napa, heirloom tomatoes specifically, to talk about that, are there's nothing like them for anybody who's never tried them. They're worth coming out here just
right.
For that.
Absolutely.
Alone.
No, we do, we had like 18 different varieties last year, all different. And plus, you know, we share, because we have more food than we can ever eat, and we have, you know, our chickens too, so we get fresh eggs every day, but. Well, we share with our workers, so we
do you
like
ever
to...
leave the property at all? Is there any reason to leave the property?
Oh yeah, no, we do. We have a lot of good restaurants in Napa Valley, so we do leave. Yeah,
a lot of good restaurants.
Yeah.
So, getting back to the wine itself, where are you crushing? Are you working a custom crush facility? Or...
We're doing a custom crush facilities, Spelotex cellars, and it's small, and they have their own little small winery, but it's very clean. Very accommodating, very good for us.
I think that's something people should know, is that so many of the wineries here in Napa are extraordinarily clean. And that might sound like, well, duh, but it's not. I mean, because of bacteria and the concerns, it is a big deal. And when you see it for yourself, especially when you tour these wineries, it goes to show the work that goes into it, which also reflects in the dollar signs at the end.
Right.
Okay, yeah. I had to have my little stand on the soapbox there. Thanks, I feel very good now.
Drink some more wine.
Rich, are you specifically the winemaker then?
No, I don't. I have a winemaker, Brian Graham. And Brian actually trained in Bordeaux for a while. And I tend to go for the Bordeaux style, you know, the reds. And Brian, I met him in 2006 at the Napa Valley Wine Auction. A barrel tasting, and liked his wine, and so we started talking, and so I brought him on as the winemaker. He's done a very good job for us, really a good winemaker, a little shy, I think, but...
Do you both get involved in the process? Are you involved in any degree of blending, or...
We do. In the blending, we try to get involved with it. You know, talking about wine, I do not have a good palate, and I tell people that, and they go, oh, how can you... And I don't. My wife has an exceptional, Adam has an exceptional palate, and of course the winemaker. And, you know, but they'll pick up the glass and say, do you smell the vanilla in it? No, I don't. I mean, it's, you know, we all have different tastes, but I know what I like. And I taste it, and it's good. It's a good wine. So, I mean, I'm very honest with people, and I tell them I can't do that. It's not what it's all about. I mean, Robert Mondavi, I remember Robert Mondavi sitting there with one of the top wines and cutting it with water. It's not a god. It's just something to enjoy.
It's fermented grape juice.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. And this is also a guy who used to have wine in his espresso, as I recall, from when he was very young.
Yeah.
At least that's what I read about him.
Definitely.
So.
But our son, when he was small, we'd pour a little wine in and let him taste it, and then, you know, cut it with water, so basically it's grape juice, right? You know, he's 25 now. But he's not a big drinker out there doing anything like that because he's been brought up with it all his life. So.
I think that's one of our problems in America, right? We don't raise our children to appreciate what alcohol is. We simply make it a taboo. Therefore, everybody wants to do it.
Everyone wants to do it. You're right.
But I want to go back to what you said and what you sort of confessed to, if you will, about not having a great palate. I appreciate that, and I think a lot of wine fans do, because the simple reason is, right, you're showing people, drink what you like. You see it probably from a very different angle, Adam, because of your background, because of your palate, and maybe in your own way, and I'm just saying this, I don't know if you do, but maybe you sort of dissect it a little bit. But for our listeners to hear that, that's very meaningful.
One of the things that I talk about when people come to the vineyard, they talk about ratings, they talk about a good wine versus a bad one, and I said there really is no such thing. Because it's all subjective, you know, and if you follow ratings, the only way to really accurately follow ratings is to know the palate of that person that is rating them. They might like really acidic wines. They might like big wines that are not necessarily your style. So they're going to give those the big scores, and then, you know, you taste it, it's not to your liking at all. So. And also, you know, you have wine enthusiast, wine spectator, wine advocate. They could all rate the same wine and be off by 10 points. So who's right, who's wrong, it doesn't really matter. It's all about your individual palate, whether you like it or you don't like it. So it's just about trying as many wines as you can and then going with the ones that taste good to you.
And would you say, as someone that has an educated palate, that when you do a blind tasting, you can be prejudiced by something. You could have number three wine is absolutely a phenomenal wine, one you've had before, but yet the other two could prejudice you. Is that possible?
Go ahead.
I think so. I mean, the best tasting is a blind tasting. You don't know what you're drinking. I mean, a paper, you know, put it in a paper bag, and because a lot of people will see the name and decide that, oh, okay, that I know they've gotten good ratings, so that's a good wine.
The name or even the value, I mean.
The value. And the value is amazing, yeah.
I can't tell you how many times we've done blind tastings with, like, big hitter Napa cabs, you know, $80, $90 a cab, and then we'll throw in a couple of $10, you know, bottles of wine. And believe it or not, they generally score better. And that may be because most people's palate's a little more sweet. They don't like maybe the austerity of some of those more expensive wines, and it's something they're even used to because they're drinking a lot more $10 wines than $80, $90 wines. But once again, it has nothing to do with price and quality ratio. It's kind of, you like what you like, you know.
Complexity can be lost on a lot of people who simply enjoy for the taste and maybe to a great degree the social aspect of it.
Yeah, and it's a lot of it has to do with packaging. I mean, you know, there's statistics out there that say 50% of most wine is purchased by the label. So it's not even what's in it. It's, does the label appeal to me? Does it speak to me as a person? Is it who I am? You know, is it fun and flippant and, you know, or is it serious and stately? You know, that's what draws us to buy wine is a lot of the packaging. So if you take it out of the packaging, you put it in a box. I mean, I'd like to see someone take some 82 Petrus and put it in a box and pour it into a glass and have a bunch of wine snobs kind of poo-poo it. Because, you know, it came out of a box. And it's Merlot, and everyone's, you know, down on Merlot, but some of the best wines in the world are Merlot.
I don't understand anybody being down on Merlot, but that's simply a matter of whether it be blamed on sideways or whether it just be blamed on cheap talk.
And actually it was sideways. It was kind of interesting. But what did he drink at the end?
As I recall, it was the Cheval Blanc, which was
Merlot.
But people don't know that.
I know.
It's like just like Petrus. People don't know that. You know, they just...
And someone, I have not read the book, but someone told me the book actually, the reason he didn't like Merlot is because his wife liked Merlot.
Oh.
His ex-wife. Yeah, I have no idea.
This is the end of part two. Visit lifebetweenthevines.com to download part 3.